Blog Talk Radio.
Live to see it, friends. You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist, and you can find us online at speculist.com. That's S-P-E-C-U-L-I-S-T.com. Or go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we talk about emerging technologies and emerging possibilities. We talk about what's happening in the world today, and we talk about where we think the world is going. In short, we talk about the future, and we're not afraid to take a rather unusual view of the future. We believe that if you're not excited about the future, maybe you're just not paying as close attention as you should. We believe that the world might just be getting better all the time, and we believe that something is going to happen, something wonderful. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you, man?
I am super fantastic. How are you doing, buddy?
Very good, very good. Did you catch Watchmen this week?
I did, and we've got to talk about that a little bit, I think, huh? For one thing, let me give you two reasons why we need to talk about Watchmen, okay?
Okay.
One is we always talk about all the new comic book movies when they come out.
Right, got to, so yeah. It's just.
And two is we both saw it, so.
That's right.
There's no danger of anything getting spoiled for either of us, so we're in great shape. So
it's just our audience we have to worry about, right?
Well, you know, hey, they have chosen to listen, so they know that we can. This show's all about spoiling the future. So, without spoilers, though, what did you think?
Without spoilers, thought that it was interesting. It was brilliant. It was weird. It was troubling, I should say. You know, there was, you know, some messages within the movie that were challenging in some ways, and then sometimes you just flat disagree with what, you know, it seems like the artists are trying to say, and then you realize, well, maybe the artists aren't even trying to say that. So, I mean, yeah, it's morally complex and just, you know, wild and weird and interesting throughout and brilliantly done. So, you know, it's not anything I could recommend to a majority of the people I know, including my parents, my wife, my kids, my, you know, on and on. But it's just a strange and interesting movie. It's one of a kind.
Yeah, I think I would recommend it. Parts of it just astounding beyond belief. Although I would say, you know, based on your response to it, that some parts you're not sure you agree, and then you're not really sure if they're saying that. That kind of speaks well to the movie. I mean, that says that, at least to a certain extent, Watchmen has achieved what it is touted to be, purported to be, which is, you know, serious literature, right? A real artistic endeavor above and beyond the standard comic book fare. So, you know, to the extent that you have this kind of complex response to it, okay, you know, I'll say that speaks well to the material, that it's got a lot of levels, and it's not just clubbing you over the head with everything. Its politics was I thought interestingly ridiculously out of date, and I know that it was written at a different era, and they put it back in that era, but even in the era it was written, I think having the political situation that it had was supposed to be, it's like I think they were saying, we're going to take this, you know, president from another time, have him be president now, because that's our way of ribbing on the then current president, which all seems like a lot of trouble to go to now, you know, this many years later. Maybe they could have handled that a little bit differently. But here's my final scoop on Watchmen. Okay, other than the fact that I think Dr. Manhattan really needs to wear pants. All right, I would appreciate it. I would consider it a personal favor if he would wear pants. But the other thing is, when I gave my when we did our little quick synopsis, quick discussion of The Dark Knight. To me, that movie all came down to this one moment where people were put in an impossible situation, and they had this this horrible choice that they had to make. and it seemed like there was no good resolution to that problem, if you recall. And right. I was very moved and impressed by how the story resolved that. Okay. Now,
right.
It's a very different kind of dilemma, but Watchmen presents us with another kind of a choice. And it says, and I won't say what any of this is, but would it be worth X if we were guaranteed Y? And it
right.
gives us an answer to that. And I look at that and I say, you know what? I don't buy this. I don't
right.
buy this the way I bought that in Dark Knight. So, good movie, recommended. Visually brilliant and all the stuff you said, but it's no Dark Knight. That would be my.
You don't buy that it would be worth. You know, the ends don't always justify the means, and the means here are pretty awful. Okay.
They're pretty extreme means. Yeah, they are.
Yeah.
But I think that goes to the whole political background in the movie, and you know how I feel about politics anyway. So.
Right.
Go ahead.
I was just thinking, you know, utopians can be dangerous. Are we in agreement that a person who is utopian in their mindset is can be a dangerous person?
Well, yeah, except for me. I'm okay. Yes, generally.
Well, that's something we tend to try to guard against at the Speculus. You know, yeah, we pump the future every chance we get. We get out there and try to, we're fans of the future, okay? But we're not utopians, though. We always believe that there's going to be problems, and
the way I like to put it is we're reserved utopians. We're utopians with a footnote, which is that when utopia gets here, it's still not utopia, and actually we already live in it, but it only looks like it from the past. It doesn't look like it from the present. The real perfect utopian future, yeah, that's crazy. You don't get
well, and also we would also qualify ourselves in this way. Innocent people don't need to pay the ultimate price to get the quote utopia that we're hoping for. You know, I mean, we don't have to resort to genocide to get to the future
like
we're hoping for.
We're dancing around spoilers at this point, so
let's leave it at that. And but anyway, it was a troublesome movie, but visually awesome.
I agree with that statement 100%. Absolutely.
Okay.
However, if innocent people want to pay $3.99, we might help them out and get a new view of the future. Okay. So I had nothing to hawk for $3.99, but okay. So last week we went through Harvard Business Review's top 20 breakthrough ideas for 2009. We took the first 10 of them.
By the way, Michael, we've forgotten Michael. Michael, good evening. How are you doing?
I'm good. I didn't feel forgotten.
Okay, good.
fresh from Robot Club. Actually, I was going to squeeze Michael in between last week and this week, so I hadn't completely forgotten you. We just
fresh from Robot Club, where I'm. Oh, that didn't sound good.
You're still with us.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Fresh from Robot Club, where I coach a team of six 9 and 10-year-old kids who are building a robot into a transition period between Robot Club and dinner, where I happened to catch the Saturday Night Live thing on TV tonight, where they were doing all the commercial satires, and I saw the robot insurance for all the robots that were attacking senior citizens, and me and my 9-year-old were both cracking up, thinking that was the greatest thing to come on right after Robot Club.
that's a great bit anyway, but to see it right after Robot Club is just perfect. Hey, so how's the robot coming along? How are you guys doing on that?
Yeah, just so we're clear, our robot would have a hard time killing insects, let alone senior citizens, because it's confined to a 4x8 table with a boundary. And in fact, I think we proved today that getting it to leave the table would be very, very difficult. But it comes out of the first foundation, Dean Kamen's creation, to inspire kids to learn more and think more about science and technology. This team is in the first Lego League, which is for ages 9 to 14. The level up from that, which is the Robotic Challenge, ages 14 to 18, we're going to go to the regionals. In fact, Phil, you should join us for this Fear in Town. we're going to go to the regional competition that'll be here in Denver in a couple weeks. And man, these robots could kill people. We went last year, and some of the bots are 60 tall. Not a battle bot competition. They design a very specific challenge, whether it's blow up a balloon or help somebody across the street or whatever. I'm euphemizing to make a point here that you come up with very specific challenges for these teams, and then kids are cutting sheet metal and molding fiberglass and building big bohonkin' robots.
That's
very cool. I'll see about trying to make it to that. I'll bring my camcorder. Maybe we'll get some video of that. We can put it up on YouTube and put that on the site. I think everybody would be interested in seeing these robots in action. And, Robot Club, great example of a real breakthrough idea. I mean, it's not necessarily a business breakthrough idea, but just the idea of getting kids together, getting them interested in science, getting them interested in technology, and in doing this kind of project is a true breakthrough idea. So last week we talked about 10 of these breakthrough ideas for business, and I was going to recap, but I think we're going to push it just getting through our 10 tonight. So we will not recap. We'll just bring them up as they become relevant as we work through the second 10. And then next week, we're going to stay on this topic, but what's going to happen, Stephen, you and I and Michael and all our listeners, we're going to come up with our own breakthrough ideas, and we're going to see if we can top Harvard Business Review in terms of coming up with breakthrough ideas both for business and for the world in general. But let's go through the next 10 breakthrough business ideas from Harvard Business Review, and I'll start with the first one, a central nervous system for the Earth, and this was by R. Stanley Williams. And this is one of the coolest things ever, okay? What Williams describes is researchers at HP are putting together, developing a model for nanoscale sensors, which they say could evolve into a global sensor network. The sensors would be used to predict things like catastrophic failure of machinery or structures like bridges or buildings or anything that could fall apart like that. They might also serve to detect explosives and toxic materials or to detect infectious biological agents. So you would have this whole layer of protection against being exposed to those kinds of things. Now, what the plan here is, HP wants to develop what they call a central nervous system for the Earth, and the abbreviation for that is capital C, little e, big N, S-E, and I presume it's pronounced SENSE. And they're looking for early adopters in manufacturing and construction, and they predict that there will be consumer applications like using cell phones to confirm – I thought this was a really interesting example – using cell phones to confirm whether produce labeled as organic really is. I looked at that and I said, look, you got these sensors. Consumers could use that to test just about any food in a supermarket and see if its contents jibe with what was listed on the label. So I think this sounds like a very, very cool breakthrough idea. I think it's neat that a big company like HP is working on this. Stephen, what's your take?
I see it as a continuing and a deepening of the of the networks that we already have, like the internet. It's a little bit like the Google Maps map apps that you can put on the iPhone that can tell you, not only where you're at but where other stuff is, like the nearest dry cleaner. It might be able to tell you like where the best air quality is in town, best drinking water, quietest neighborhoods, things like that. And I was noticing in the chat, Michael was saying that the privacy implications are huge. I would think so. Imagine if you had sensors basically everywhere that could sense the odor of marijuana burning or something. Huge stuff like that.
Well, what if you could? Now that we're on a roll here, and as soon as you mentioned privacy, I started thinking, what if people had an app on their iPhone that would work in a bar setting to test the person in the chair next to them for sexually transmitted disease, right? I mean, I don't know.
There's news you could use right there, so.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. It's important to me to know whether this produce is really organic. I would think something like that would be even more so, and that's really an extension of the whole we're detecting for poisons and for pathogens and those kinds of things. But But as soon as it becomes your business, what's going on inside somebody else's body? I think Michael's concerns about privacy are fairly well founded. You know, the application that I thought of for this was airline security. If you had this kind of sensors in place, you could, you know, forget all these scanners and all that nonsense. If anyone's got explosives on them, if they've got weapons on them of any kind, if they're carrying poisons, anything would be detectable, and it would be completely transparent to the user. You would just be getting ready to get on the plane, and probably if there was ever any question about anyone, they would just be, you know, shuffled off to one side. There wouldn't be this nonsense of having everybody take their shoes off and, you know, put their liquids or gels into a 1-quart bag. You would just it would be completely transparent, and I think this is important, effective, which would be a nice thing for airport security to be.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you would want that would be cool to be able to just, you know, walk right straight through some of these sensors and not having, you know, since you're a good guy, you don't have to worry about it. And the one bad guy out of thousands is easily caught. That would be the ideal security system.
Absolutely. So.
Yeah.
I see this one as far as on the breakthrough scale. This is a good one. This one works for me from a business standpoint, but also from a speculative standpoint. This looks like an important breakthrough for us as a civilization, and I expect to see this happening probably over the next few years.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, let me just say this is Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. We're working through items 11 through 20 on the Harvard Business Journal's list of top 20 breakthrough ideas for 2009, and we're coming up on number 2. Stephen's going to tell us about a looming American diaspora.
Absolutely. This is the idea of a brain drain, basically, that the smart, talented people within the United States will go where the jobs are. And this author of this particular article, Paul Sappho, is basically saying that the world's getting smaller all the time, and you know, a great job in Japan might receive a person that's, you know, the most talented person in the world may get it instead of just the most talented person in Tokyo, and so that's the way that will tend to go, and he sees a lot of folks leaving the United States in that way.
Yeah, he gives some interesting examples of that. He talks about these universities in Singapore recruiting top U.S. talent, which I didn't realize that was going on. I thought that was very interesting. And he talks about this steady flow of executives, expats from Silicon Valley moving to China. But the one that really got my attention was Midwestern farmers moving to Brazil because the real estate is cheap, and they can get a start there doing farming. And I guess it's much more economically advantageous. So it's not just brain drain the way you would normally think of it in the executive level. It's I guess enterprising people from all walks of life within business. When you see that happening in agriculture as well as what you would typically think of, the high tech kinds of businesses where this would apply, it starts to be a really interesting looking phenomenon. However, I'm not sure that I'm completely sold that Sappho has made his case. For one thing, he didn't cite any hard numbers on this at all. It was all anecdotal, you know, how you see all these people moving from Silicon Valley to China. Because the point is, Americans have been moving overseas. They've been, you know, looking for and finding opportunities overseas forever, right? I mean, that's been going on for decades, and you know, you'll see it happen with the oil companies. You know, new opportunities will open up. I worked overseas myself,
many times
in telecom. Yeah, well, in telecom, I lived overseas for a period of like 5 years, and I came back. And I would be interested in seeing how many of these executives leaving Silicon Valley going to China actually spend the rest of their lives there, or even a significant portion of their lives there. It'd be very interesting for me to see how many of them go, they have their adventure, and then they come back. If we're really seeing people make a lifetime decision to go live in other countries, that is in percentages greater than what we've seen in the past. That is truly a new thing, but I'm not sure he's made the case here. Of course, he only has a few paragraphs to do it, but I'm not necessarily worried about this one yet. I would want to see more data.
Well, to make this a little more topical to, you know, the here and now, have you heard the phrase "going John Galt" here lately? Have you caught that over at Insta Pundit? Oh yeah. Well, I mean, I suppose that if a person were dissatisfied with the political status quo, whether it was under the last president or under this one, this would be one ultimate way of handling it. I suppose is just to leave the country. You know.
let's say you're a good objectivist, and you're a good Ayn Rand follower, and you object to the way things are happening in the U.S. today, that the government's getting too big, taxes are getting too high. You're gonna what? You're gonna go live in communist China, right? Instead,
there's no capital gains tax there, I understand, but you're right.
Okay, fair enough. I think without Galt's Gulch. People attempting to go John Galt, and maybe that's what these farmers are doing, going to Brazil. Maybe that's what they're doing. Maybe Brazil has become their Galt Gulch. That's an interesting thought, if so. But I would say, by and large, there are a few, if any, places you can go that are more suitable to the Ayn Rand view of the world than the U.S. You know, if you want to go John Galt, you got to start Galt Gulch in this country, I think. I don't think you're going to be pleased. Certainly, you don't want to go to Singapore.
Yeah.
I don't think you're going to be pleased with the results. But that's an
once upon a time, Hong Kong was pretty. You could be John Galt in Hong Kong, but maybe not so much now that it's in China's hands again.
Yeah, I'm not sure it would be as effective a place to go John Galt. I guess the other side of that is you can go some places where officially. They're more restrictive, but you can live more or less off the books. There might be some places like that. Although, again, I wouldn't try it in China. That's a personal observation on my part. Okay, let's move on to item number three, Harnessing Social Pressure by Noah J. Goldstein. This is really interesting. He talks about how research shows that peer influence can have a positive effect on influencing customer behavior. And here's the example, one of the examples he gives. You tell hotel guests that most of the guests staying in the hotel reuse their towels. And if you tell them that persuades more guests to reuse towels than would have using the other persuasion techniques. What you usually see is there's a card that says, you know, save the earth, save the planet, you know, keep using your
one towel at a time.
Yeah, that's right. The environmental appeal, I think, is not working that well. And, of course, Goldstein goes into the real business of it. It's cost him $1.50 or more a day to replace these towels. So that's, you know, all this environmental concern on the part of hotels, I think, has a lot more to do with saving that $1.50.
Right.
But if you tell people not, hey, save the planet, but rather, you know, most people who stay in this room do reuse their towels. Okay,
yeah.
Like that's much.
I wonder how you would phrase that in such a way as to not be, you know, real passive aggressive like that. I mean, what do I mean, you have to be masterful in the communication of that.
Yeah, I would not phrase it the way I just did. That's yeah. Now you're still making, I'm sure, the environmental appeal,
yeah.
And you're asking them to join with
do as most people in this room do, save the planet by reusing your towel.
You point out how you're pleased that most of the guests who've stayed here have done the same. So, you know,
what I thought was also interesting is how it can work negatively too.
Mm-hmm.
If you somehow inform people that we have a real problem with people stealing the the ashtrays out of the room. Please don't steal the ashtray. Those ashtrays go missing more often. I thought that was interesting.
That's very. It's almost like permission at that point. And Goldstein calls this the magnetic middle. That people are drawn to what the majority does. So if you tell people, hey, most people are reusing their towels, if you say, hey, too many people are stealing ashtrays, they start stealing ashtrays. Or the example they give is really interesting in Petrified National Forest in Arizona. People stealing the petrified wood out of the park, so they put up signs saying, "Hey, don't do that. We got a lot of people doing that," and it apparently increased the incidences of people doing that. Another one that was really interesting was the utility company in California telling families, I guess probably in a printout on their bill, that they were consuming less power than their neighbors, did not lead to them continuing to be good neighbors. It led to them starting to, not bad neighbors, but it led to them using more power than they had before.
Yeah.
And it goes to show you that, you know, this whole idea of peer pressure, that's not just something for kids. We think of that as something that kids experience. It's something that happens when you're in school. And apparently it's a very powerful social force that is acting on all of us all the time.
Yeah.
So from a scientific standpoint, as far as interesting research, I would have to give this one a, did not know that, I think, on this one. As far as applicability, I don't know that I look forward to, but I expect to see more and more instances in the near future of being told what most people have done in certain circumstances.
It's interesting. Michael mentioned – I'm sorry, Phil. I cut in on you. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. I finished.
Okay. Michael was talking about smiley faces on your bill from the power company and things like that. That's actually happening somewhere, I think in Colorado. You don't get a smiley face on your bill when you save power, do you?
You know what? I never look at the paper bill. I do everything online, and there's no smiley face online. But that's interesting. That if that smiley face means that you're not using as much power as others, that could be working against them. So they Xcel Energy, they need to be careful there. They're going to end up encouraging people to use more power rather than less.
Yeah, I've got a big old smiley face. That means I can, you know, leave the lights on.
Exactly. I'm turning the thermostat up a little or down.
I've been cold. Right?
Yeah, exactly.
That's
okay, well, that takes us to number four, Western Union World. What's that one all about, Steve?
Well, this one's about immigrants. Talking about, you know, we got 200 million immigrants worldwide. You know, that's people going from one country and, you know, where their country of origin and living in another country. And what's happening is creating this huge market where people can, you know, they work in their jobs, they send money back home, they bring their culture with them. They don't just abandon their culture and completely embrace the culture they go to. And it's an interesting market that this particular author thinks is being missed by most marketers, Phil. So I know you're in marketing, so that's an interesting thing for you.
I got to get right on the migrants. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Well, go ahead.
Go ahead. Well, I was going to say this fits in like this fits real well with one of our last articles about the looming American diaspora. So I mean, you know, it's the idea that talented people tend to go where the opportunities take them, whether they're leaving this country and going elsewhere or leaving some other country and coming here. And so, you know, I think staying in touch, the ability to stay in touch through the internet and other means like that. It's becoming more and more possible and easy to do, and so you know, people to a great extent are going to take their country with them as they go, and that creates an interesting hodgepodge effect, I think, throughout the world.
Well, it does. I think it opens the world up in a lot of ways, and you know that this is kind of the other side of the coin. Here you see the Latin American diaspora. Here you see the Indian and other parts of Asian diaspora at work in this migration to the U.S. and not just the U.S. You know, it's into Europe and elsewhere in the world. One of the things that got my attention on this was, well, we look at the American diaspora, I think, as potentially a threat because we say, oh no, brain drain, we'll lose our skills, we'll lose our talents. And no doubt in Mexico and other countries, they would say the same thing. But one of the things that Suarez Orozco points out here in this piece is that in 2007, expatriates remitted about $350 billion, more than three times what the wealthy member states of the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development gave in aid to the entire developing world to relatives left behind. That's how this got its name, Western Union World. Western Union is one of the companies that has successfully marketed to migrants, and they've like doubled their revenues over the last over the 5 years from 2002 to 2007 by catering to these folks. But you look at that, $350 billion, that's a huge flow of money back to those countries. And it's kind of like, see, when I look at those two stories compared to each other, it's kind of like, you know, you never hear about the wind chill on a hot day, right? You only hear about it on a cold day. So wind chill is always the thing that makes the Right, it's cold weather, colder. It's like, okay, well, so if we're going to have this American diaspora, that means all these Americans overseas are going to be sending mucho bucks back to the U.S. from all these high-paying jobs that they're going to be getting in these other countries. That means money's going to be flowing back to us in the same way that this $350 billion flowed to these other countries. So it looks to me like it just becomes more of a kind of a patchwork world. We go to where the opportunities are. Other people come here because opportunities are here, and money finds its way around the world. It really all kind of speaks to what we hope is going to be the free market in action. And it looks like when you compare those two stories, there's something to be said for maybe that whole free market thing is actually working.
Absolutely.
Okay, well, this is Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. We're zipping through our 10 breakthrough ideas from Harvard Business Journal. Phil and Stephen talking about these things. And if you'd like to join our discussion, if you're listening live, join us in our online live chat or leave comments at blog.speculus.com. Okay, so our next item, item number 5 by Alex Pentland, was How Social Networks Network Best. And this starts out with a fascinating bit of information from the bee world that I did not know. He talks about how bees locate a new hive, a location for a new hive, by sending out individual scouts to look for good possible sites for the new hive. And
right.
the scouts who then find a likely site, they're going to report back, and through this elaborate dance routine that gets picked up by other bees, eventually the whole thing goes viral and one site becomes the winner. And the whole thing sounded to me like nothing in the world so much as how a video goes viral on YouTube and suddenly becomes the one that everybody watches. I mean, it's like bees live in the social network to choose their place of residence, kind of the way we choose what we're going to read on our computers. Now, what Pentland says is going on. He says there's two dynamics that are of relevance to business. He says first you have a centralized effort to go locate new sites. So the bees, everybody go look for new sites. And then you have this decentralized network arrangement where the new site is chosen. And he says that in the business world, successful teams are going to, just like bees, they're going to oscillate between a centralized model and a network model in order to get their objectives done. And then he gives some statistics. He says that employees with a strong electronic network are 7% more productive than those with a strong face than those who don't have that, or those with a strong face-to-face network are 30% more productive than people without those kinds of networks. So what do we think? Do we need to be studying social networks to make business work better, Stephen?
Yeah, I think so. For one thing, you can find out a lot about your own product, how it's being accepted within the market by what's going on in the social networks. I think companies better watch what's happening out there in the social networks, and if their product is hot out there or if it's being trashed out there, they better be aware and deal with that. For the better, if they're being trashed, or just make some improvements and get the word out that they've made improvements, or start making more units if something's really taken off. You better be aware.
Yeah, social networks seem to provide an additional way for good ideas to rise to the top, and for ideas that are mediocre or not good to be filtered out. So if you have this. Where I'm not sure I agree is it seems to me that in most social networks, it's also a decentralized matter of, no one gives anyone instructions to go out and read YouTube, see what the latest video on YouTube is. People just go do it. So to me, it feels like it's kind of decentralized in both places, but maybe suggesting that would...
It works because I think the only instance in which it's centralized, or the only way in which it's centralized, is that they're all reporting back to a central location, like in the case of Dig. You got decentralized people going out, and they're self-interested. They're not interested in helping anybody else but themselves. But then they might plug something in Dig, and then the weight of it reaches a tipping point, and then everybody's going to go see something that a bunch of people say is great. And so that's an example of how that works. Ditto with eBay. You got independent, decentralized, self-interested sellers but they're gathering in a central location to try to sell to independent, decentralized, self-interested buyers. So, yeah, it's and PodSafe Music Network works that way. I mean,
you're
so
right.
Many,
the
many
central things. The central point is the site. It's the
yeah.
It's the application or the actual environment that's connecting everyone together. That's the real centralized part. Yeah, I get it. Okay, that makes sense. Well, you know, that I really started thinking about that video you put up from Conan O'Brien, Louis C.K. talking about everything's amazing and no one's happy.
Yeah.
When did you put that up? 2 weeks ago, maybe 3 weeks ago? It's been a while.
Yeah.
Because that thing has enjoyed this huge arc on the web. After, not that our putting it up there had anything to do with that, or it might have
part of
contributed
it.
In a small way, but suddenly a few days later, I see that InstaPundit has linked it, and then I'm at work, and a coworker who is not into the speculus or any of that kind of stuff says, "Hey, you're going to love this. Look at this," and shows me that video. And then Friday, I'm driving to work, and I'm listening to Dennis Miller, and he's recommending it, and I'm thinking, "Yeah, see, this is a." All the efforts to push that idea are completely decentralized. But you're right. Ultimately, it all comes back to that one link, that one site where that video sits, and that's completely centralized.
Yeah.
Apparently,
we're getting linked to on that Dachshund video with the automatic ball fetching machine or ball.
Yeah, that one seems to have caught on too. Yeah, absolutely. get quite a few responses on that. Well, that's a great video. I really enjoyed that one a lot. I could watch that all day. I want to get one of those for my dogs. Okay, well, we're at the halfway point and more than halfway through the show. So just very quickly, I wanted to check in with Michael. Michael, any reflections from the chat room that you'd care to share on our first five of our 10 breakthrough ideas?
Well, I'm because, power of the microphone, power of the pen, all that thing. I'm just going to say the central nervous system for planet Earth is, of the 20 on this list, far and away the most interesting one, far and away the biggest breakthrough. The fact that the development team at HP is public about this thing and trying to commercialize it, I think speaks well to the possibility of it. And it makes the rest of this list pale in comparison. That said, okay, David, Ray raised an interesting point when you guys were talking about Western unionizing the world, whatever that one was. I read that one the first time, and I thought it was Westworld. And I'm like, oh, Yul Brynner as a robot coming to get us. No, that's not it.
You're spending too much time worrying about robots.
That's right. Okay, David, Ray did ask the question, could a telepresence – and I would tend to think of it more as a holographic presence, but could a telepresence make immigration obsolete? And I think that's from a technology point of view, that's a great question. From a social point of view, we're miles from that. I mean, we'll let money go from country to country. We're not going to let the workers go country to country quite that easy, not yet anyway.
Yeah.
Interesting thought, though. Yeah. So instead of moving to China, we might telecommute to China.
Sure. And I'm
well,
sure
some jobs are better for that than others. Yeah.
That's
I could telecommute as an attorney a lot easier than a dentist.
But not to China. Because
yeah.
You really can't practice law in China.
True that. Yeah, that's true.
But
it'd be more like the marketing guy who can do that. My skills are just equally applicable everywhere, right?
Or equally. How would you say superfluous?
Yeah, that's okay. You don't need to say anything else.
Saying,
I think I summed it up quite well.
Nobody's more superfluous than me. the Louis C.K. thing, it was funny that you mentioned that because I noticed in the past week it came back to me from somebody that I didn't expect to send it back to me. But he sent it back to me with, oh, somebody put me out of this. I think you thought I thought you'd think it was funny. And I saw it, and I'm like, didn't I send this to him like 6 months ago? I didn't go
right.
out of the look. But then I started to realize, wait a minute, three different people – unconnected to each other by any way I know, sent me a reference to that in the last couple of weeks. I'm like, yeah, it's bubbling, and somehow people think I would think that's funny. Now, I do think it's funny, but, it's interesting to me that not only would they think that, but I saw it first many years ago, and then I saw it again recently when Stephen put it up, and then, now all these other people are sending it to me. I don't know how that happens.
So that's not a particularly recent appearance by Louis C.K. on Conan
O'Brien. 4 years
old. That's interesting.
He was on Conan. That was years ago.
That's amazing. Isn't that
yeah.
something? Huh.
Sometimes things just have to bubble for a while, you know, before percolate for a while before it really catches.
They hit a tipping point. I think the Speculist was the tipping point.
Here's the killer for that, though. The killer for that for me is he's talking about the guy who gets on an airplane and goes, "Yeah, I got Wi-Fi, I got high-speed broadband internet on the plane." And then it breaks, and, you know, oh, that's bullshit. Like, I have this entitlement to something I didn't even know existed 10 minutes ago, which is the funny part. That is funny. What kills me is I don't get Wi-Fi everywhere I go, and it's like 3 years after that conversation. It's like they were testing Wi-Fi, and they just didn't, you know, they don't do it now.
That's true. That's true. The expectation, that's interesting that that's 4 years old, because I would have thought that was something they were testing right now. That's one of the things that made it seem recent to me. But you're right, they were testing that a while back, and we still don't have it on domestic flights. I think only a few airlines provide it on national flights, international flights. Very interesting stuff. Okay, we have to move quickly on to Should You Outsource Your Brain by Thomas H. Davenport. Stephen, take us through that one.
Okay, this is the idea that you know, not only do we have call centers in India, but also analysts in India and elsewhere, I'm sure, Beijing, other places like that, would be analyzing American company business or a business from any place throughout the world and issuing opinions and actually sometimes, in some cases, going forward with actions. For the business, and so basically you're outsourcing the brain of the organization to wherever brains happen to be, and it's and according to the author Davenport, this is a big deal, and it's a coming thing, and going to be more and more important as time goes by.
Well, what's interesting to me about this one is here's the question this one raises for me. Okay, if you've outsourced production, you know, if you've offshored that, and then all forms of support and all your back office stuff, that's all been moved offshore too, right? And now you're going to take decision making. You're going to take the top level management stuff and move that offshore. What do you got left, right?
And you got a filing. You got corporate filings in Delaware, and you've got some American stockholders, and that's about it.
Yeah, you know, hold the office picnic. You're gonna spend the whole year planning that. You know, that's all employees left in the U.S. That's their job, I think. So to me, this is the real, if there's a brain drain issue, it would be this one. It would be we're not going to do that decision-making stuff anymore. We're gonna move that one offshore, except for the fact that I know that big companies have been leaving some decisions to third parties for a long time.
Right.
And that's this whole business of you bring in a consultant, you bring in an analyst, and you know, we're going to allow them to make this unbiased, neutral, third-party decision for us so that, a lot of times it's so I don't have to take the blame. But there's also because it'll look, you know, it will avoid all the biases and we'll get a better decision out of it. So
right.
So now it's like, okay, well, that's that same thing, only you're pushing it offshore. But, you know, where's the decision really being made? I think that these consulting companies that Davenport lists are using expert systems. They're using IT that they've developed, software programs that they've developed, really limited AI. I mean, it's narrow AI research that these companies are doing. And so what these companies in the U.S. and Europe and elsewhere are paying for is they're sending their input. These folks in India are going to input all that into the software, and then the software is going to spit out the answer. Right. Eventually, we'll figure out to cut out the middleman on that. Right. You'll say, well, wait a second. We could own that software, and we could have the decision made in house. Right.
Ooh, I've got a brilliant idea, Phil. I tend to have, as you know.
Of course. Go ahead. What now?
Okay. What now? Yeah. Okay. Well, anyway, here's my idea. What if you had a dancing bee website where basically you let the weight of the opinion of, you know, in a social network make all your decisions for you? You know,
beautiful.
The management decisions of a company.
Everybody picks an animation matching one of the decision options out there, and as soon as all the bees are dancing a certain way, you've got your decision. Steven, you're gonna make a fortune off this one. I think. This is the one.
We got to set up a website. Yeah.
Is dancingbee.com, is that available? Somebody check that out for us real quick. We'll check back on that. All right, we got to move on. We're going to talk now about number 7, what you need to know about the semantic web. And this is by Tom Eilub, I believe is how that name is pronounced. He talks about semantic web using the World Wide Web to organize and present web content not as documents, but as items of data that are linked both by meaning and relationships. And he talks about how 23 billion relationships have already been encoded into web content using RDF, the Resource Description Framework, which I think is just an expansion of XML. XML was not mentioned in this, but I think XML slash RDF are like in the same family. So if anyone's hearing RDF and they're thinking, what about XML? I think it's all the same thing. But yeah. Here's what he says. He says, the semantic web is built on standards and protocols that clearly define the relationship of each data item to others, not just within the document, but wherever those other data may be on the entire web. At present, people must wade through and make sense of search results. The semantic web would enable computers to interact with other computers to assemble data items that are precisely responsive to highly specific queries. And he gives they give an example of – actually, I don't think he did. I think I looked this up myself. FOAF, it's a – what's that called? A friend of a friend. It's a machine-readable ontology that describes people and their activities and their relations to other people. So you can kind of use the web itself as sort of a social network without the need for a central social network database. So here we even get away from the central social network database. Now, this guy, Tim Berners-Lee, who came up with the phrase semantic web, he's now introduced a very interesting term, giant global graph, to describe what he thinks the web of the future will be. We won't have the WWW anymore. We're going to have the GGG, the giant global graph that's going to give us this highly socially and meaning-linked web of the future. What do you think, Stephen, when you read about the semantic web?
I see a huge legal minefield for businesses going forward. And here's why I think so, because imagine, let's say I've got widget.com where I'm trying to sell widgets, okay? And so I am this hardworking businessman producing as many widgets as I can out here, and you know the people come to my website and I want to control the presentation, right? I want to control everything that's going on that they see, that they, you know, if they want to go and Google me, they can, but they have to leave my website to do it. With the semantic web, it's almost as if, you know, they click on widget and they are directly access widgetsucks.com, you know, straight from my company's website, and that keeps my ability to be able to control the presentation. If I'm a person that's putting out widgets, that limits me. And so, I mean, if I were the manufacturer of those widgets, I think I would not like that at all. And so.
And of course, you would have the choice. You don't have to mark up your pages that way, right? You don't have to use XML slash RDF. Then you miss out on everyone hitting it the good way. But right,
yeah
you're not lumped in with all the bad stuff. So it's definitely a double-edged sword. When you think about something, to me, here's what's interesting about all this semantic web talk. For one thing, I read that article and I go, well, how will it be different, right? Because,
yeah.
You know, ultimately it says assemble data items that are precisely responsive to highly specific queries. Well, I would like precisely responsive, but as it is, you know, you have to make very precise queries anyway if you're going to filter through all the noise. My wife and I were watching South Pacific yesterday. And old movie based on a musical. And it was interesting because we got talking about whether a certain scene was or was not filmed in Malaysia. So I'm getting this idea. It's like, I want to go look for this out on the web. So what's the search I do? Well, I haven't actually done this. I was just actually concocting the search string in my mind, right? But I was thinking, okay, so I'm going to put South Pacific in quotes, and then I'm going to put Tioman Island, and then I'm going to put like Mitzi Gaynor or Wash That Man Right Out of My Hair, right? Because that was the scene I was thinking about, and that was the island in Malaysia where I thought I had heard that, and that was the name of the movie. Now, by the time I've done all three of those things, I've added an awful lot of semantic context on my own. And
right.
I wonder if the way people are using search engines is already making less whatever huge benefit is supposedly going to come into play with RDF. Maybe I'm just not seeing it, but it seems to me that we're doing pretty well kind of hacking our own complex queries just using the search engines.
Well, you know, there, I suppose a good semantic search engine would, you know, if I put in, I don't know, what's a good example of something, birthday party or something like that. It could use different words, synonyms. It would come up with synonyms for whatever I'm searching for. In other words, it wouldn't just search for the word; it would search for the idea behind the word. And
right.
That to me would be a pretty cool and an improvement over Google and all the normal search engines out there.
Except for the fact that it would only be able to search for one meaning behind the word at a time.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, well, how do you know which meaning?
Well,
of the
I'm
word
not
you
sure
know?
Of that, Phil. I think that it would make a guess as to what the is the probable meaning that you're trying to look for, but that would be, you know, that might be the first two or three listed there, and then below that there might be additional things that might be closer to what, you know, their second and third choices as to what you might be looking for. So
yeah, but again, I think it would make that guess based on the context of the other things you said.
Yeah.
Which we're already sort of providing that context. That's my point.
Okay.
But I'm eager to see it. I just can't visualize how different it's really going to be. And I'm eager to see how different it really will. Certainly all those 23 billion bits of relationships that have been coded in hopefully won't go to waste and really will provide some benefit. But let's
Michael, by
on.
The way, I was not meaning to, dance on the concept of semantic web. When I described the merchant, you know, so that's
enough.
Just from the merchant's point of view. Yeah.
Yeah,
don't
fair enough. Okay,
bees.
So
all that stuff about dancing bees has me thinking about, you know, bees are hot.
Okay.
I'll tell you, you know what's hot tonight is robots and social networks. Those seem to be the recurring themes. Everything's about social networks. How about number eight, Stephen, the business of biomimicry?
This is cool. Although I would think that this is something that's kind of been around a while. This is the idea that, you know, people that are in business are making products that mimic the things in nature. And I would think that this goes back at least as far as like the backhoe imitating the motion of an arm, you know, digging in the soil. But I mean, it seems like about a year ago I posted something on the Speculist about the boxfish being used as the model for a vehicle that's a very unusual looking vehicle. This is important. I think, instead of making solar panels out of silicon necessarily, why not imitate the leaf? And this is this is being done. I think it's a brilliant thing to go going forward. But I believe that there is a next step after we've mimicked things in nature to the extent we want to. There's a step to take after that.
And that step is actually implementing that technology or improving on what nature does?
Well, artificial evolution, basically simulating evolution within a computer to come up with solutions to problems that nature has never got around to testing. Millions of years of evolution can go by pretty fast in a sufficiently powerful computer. And you can involve all kinds of solutions that way, using the tools of nature to come up with solutions that nature has never actually, to problems nature has never actually had to deal with.
Yeah, that's a great idea. If you think about modeling or even actually in a limited environment, evolving new biological solutions to problems, which we could then map back to technological solutions. That's very cool. I would say that I would agree with you. We've been doing this forever. I think it's extremely cool that we're still doing it, or that maybe we've started paying better attention to it now with some more high-tech kinds of solutions. When you start talking about looking at desert lizards to understand lubrication technology better, or this beetle that drinks fog could lead to a technological development that would be a breakthrough in irrigation for agriculture. Those are very cool. However, sometimes nature's solution isn't the best one for us, and one of the things that threw human beings off in a big way in trying to develop heavier than air flight was paying too much attention to birds, because birds do it via moving wings, and it turned out the best approach for us was fixed wing, and we had to actually get past looking at how they did it before we were able to come up with a solution. So I'd put a caveat on biomimicry that maybe sometimes it's the best approach, and sometimes we gotta come up with something a little bit different.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay, well, we're down to 5 minutes, and we've got two left, so I'm going to say we're gonna run over just a moment or two this evening, and this is Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. We're running through a list of 10 breakthrough ideas from Harvard Business Journal. And number 9 is the Dynamics of Personal Influence, and this was by Nicholas Christakis. This is very interesting, I thought, and this is another one that goes to there's similarities here to the bees, this one also resonates with the whole telling people that the majority do things a certain way, and now will you do it that way too. This is all about influencing people's behavior. He says that we're influenced by the people around us up to three degrees of separation away, and that influence is going to dissipate with each new degree of separation, and then it will pretty much disappear after the third. And a quote here is, he says, we found that a person is 15% likelier to be happy if his or her friends are happy, 10% likelier if the friend's friends are happy, and 6% likelier if the friends of those friends' friends are happy. And then after that level, it's just the same as randomness. And then he talks about smoking. He says the risk for smoking in a person connected to a smoker, that is one degree of separation, is 61% higher.
That's
on
huge.
Average.
Yeah,
much greater than would be expected as a result of chance. It's 29% higher if the friends of that person's friends smoke, and 11% higher if the friends of the person's friends' friends smoke. So by the fourth degree of separation, you're back to, you know, there's no longer an increase in risk. So
turns out mom is right. Watch out what kind of friends you make, I guess, is the moral of this story, right?
Well, it's interesting that, you know, it should be common sense, but you get serious scientific research done, and it turns out, yeah, peer pressure is a big deal, and, oh, yeah, we're influenced by the people around us, that our behavior is much more likely to reflect the behavior of those around us, or our attitude, in the case of happiness, much more likely than the attitudes of those around us.
It's interesting how the article ends. It says the percentages show reflect influence where behavior and attitude are concerned. It would be interesting to see whether these percentages carry over to ideas and beliefs. And I say absolutely they carry over into ideas or beliefs. Do the studies and put the numbers on it. I'd be interested to see that. But we know that it happens that way. I mean, a great example of this is this famous quote. Back in 1972, Nixon beat McGovern. Remember that?
Mm-hmm.
Well, and then a movie critic by the name of Pauline Kael came out and said something, well, how can Nixon have won? Nobody I know voted for him.
Right.
Right. You just tend to hang in groups that share ideas and beliefs. And so, anyway.
There's an incredible capacity for self-reinforcement of attitudes and I guess ideas and beliefs as well as behaviors, and that's a great example of that. Actually, yeah, I think the question here is not just would those percentages carry over. I would expect them to be quite a bit higher. And one of the things that would be really interesting would be to note how are people able to maintain relationships with people where they don't have all that much in common with them? You know, you figure one of the reasons you're in relationship with someone is that you have something in common. You know, you're a blood relative, you work together. If you're friends, then it goes, you know, almost without saying that there must be common interests, if not beliefs, attitudes, behaviors.
Right.
There's got to be some core set of those things. But it'd be really interesting to get more research on this and find out how much do you have to have in common with someone to be friends with them, and to what extent are we really just reflecting back to the world what our group says. Yeah, it seems like Pauline Kael was doing an excellent job of that very thing back
One fascinating example. One fascinating counterexample is James Carville and his marriage to Madeline.
Marilyn or whatever her name is. Yeah,
I forget his wife's name, but I mean she's conservative and is a consultant for Republicans, and he's obviously on the other side of the fence. It's so funny that they managed to somehow stay together. It's hilarious, and you know James Carville's not just a little bit on the other side of the fence, but is very much on the other side of the fence. So, but somehow
absolutely they're seemingly diametrically opposed politically, although they're in the same line of work. So they do have something in common too.
I guess so. I don't know. Yeah. That's just funny.
That's a great example, though, of, you know, where's the cutoff? You know, it's like, okay, well, you would think people have to have ideology in common, but apparently they don't if they have other things making up for it. So, yeah, that's a good one. Okay, finally, number 10, Forget Citibank, Borrow from Bob by John Zviokla. Tell me about that one, Stephen.
Okay, I thought this was fascinating. This is peer-to-peer lending. The idea that, you know, instead of going to your local bank to borrow money to build your house, you go online to, peerloan.com, let's say, and you say, well, I want to borrow money for my house, and I need this amount of money, and this is the percentage rate I'm looking for, let's say, the interest rate I'm looking for, and you know, it wouldn't be just one person to come along to fill that order. Perhaps maybe it would be 50 people would come along and say, yeah, I'm good for $1,000 or this kind of thing, and I'm willing to loan it to you at this percentage. And imagine if you had an AI, for example, that is able to give to the potential lenders information about this person beyond their credit rating. These are their habits, and this is, you know, how the kind of person they are, and the, you know, that kind of thing. And that could influence the percentage rates that they're willing to go. But imagine, if let's say it takes 50 people to come along and say, yeah, we'll loan you this amount of money to add up to the amount of money that they're looking for. And then imagine that the percentage rate that these potential lenders offer, an aggregate percentage rate has come to that's within the setup of what the potential borrower is looking for, then bang, you've got a loan. And I think this is going to happen. I think that just seems obvious and sort of in many ways that's a powerful concept and could be as big as eBay when the time is right. So that's cool.
I couldn't agree more. It appears that it is happening. If you go to lendingclub.com,
okay.
this has been implemented. What's interesting to me about this is that it's a good deal for everybody. The person borrowing money, by the way, I didn't see mortgage loans on there. So it looks like it's more like personal loans rather than probably there's business loans too. Just in terms of what's actually currently offered on Lending Club. I don't think it quite goes to the level of mortgage yet, but obviously that would be somewhere down the road. But here's the thing. The borrower is going to pay less interest than they would getting a comparable loan from a bank. The lenders are making more money, a better return on that money than they would putting it in a savings account. So the banks are being cut out on both ends of this deal.
Yeah,
and
as if banks didn't have enough problems right now.
Well, unfortunately, but how did the banks get into the mess they're in right now? Well, a lot of different causes, a lot of different reasons. We're running late, so we probably don't have time to analyze it in detail, but certainly wasn't one of the causes the subprime crisis. Right,
right.
This,
subprime
this,
crisis.
This
lending
business of giving,
lending to making risky loans. That's, you know.
Yeah, making risky loans, where here you've got this kind of double reinforced. Well, they got to have a good credit rating, and the other thing they're checking, they're not quite to the AI you described yet, Stephen. But what they're doing is any information that they have on the borrower's reputation via social networks is included in this formula that determines whether someone's a good risk. So if you're on Facebook, if you're on LinkedIn, if you've got a lot of recommendations on LinkedIn, a lot of different ways of gaining credibility. Online are actually taken into consideration and make up part of your credit worthiness score on LendingClub.com. So you've got this high trust atmosphere, sort of replacing maybe the
this borrower has a lot of woofy or whatever.
Exactly. Yeah. This is the credibility economy coming online. The currency is still U.S. dollars, but what makes a person somebody that you're gonna send money their way is whether they have credibility or not. And it's interesting that this decentralized model could be the high trust, high security model compared to the centralized bank model, which is supposed to be stable and secure, which turns out to have been risky and full of problems. It's a complete, you know, it's like bizarro world. It's a complete mirror image of how we expect the world to work. But when I look at this, I say, wow, this definitely has a future. I think that this is going to be a very, very big thing.
Absolutely.
Okay, so that wraps up our 20 breakthrough business ideas from Harvard Business Journal. So of the 20, counting this week and last week, Stephen, what stands out in your mind? If you're going to pick two top ones, what would they be?
Well, the two top ones are the ones that I meshed together to come up with the idea of dancing bees as the outsource, dancingbee.com as the outsourcing, way we outsource our brain as corporations. So, you know, so I guess that's that combines two things.
Yeah, I think that just there's probably one big one that can be drawn from all this social networking. Although I have to give some props to the central nervous system for the Earth. That one,
yeah,
that one feels like
that was Michael's favorite. Yes,
that one feels like a really big one, and I think that our increasing understanding of what influences people, increasing understanding of why people behave the way they do, and how social networks can factor into taking advantage of that from a business standpoint. If I were going to make a prediction for next year's top 20 from Harvard Business Journal, I would say you'll see even more of that next year than you saw this year. So, Michael, I'll turn it over to you. What of the 10 we covered this week, or of any topics, what's happening in the chat room?
Without doubt, the central nervous system for the Earth is far and away of the 20 on this list the most compelling. And I will say, props to Stephen. I was dogging this biomimicry thing. I'm like, bricks are biomimicry. You know, the pointed stick to dig a hole in the ground is biomimicry. What's the breakthrough? You put a spin on it that actually made it much smarter than I saw it. So thanks for that.
Talking about the evolution idea, the artificial evolution.
Yeah, the idea that you could test things that nature hasn't either got around to yet or gotten around to in a way that we've seen because the evolutionary record doesn't exist for us in a way that we can measure it or see it. That's a cool concept. And if that's part of the biomimicry idea, that's way smarter than I was given it credit for. I actually will differ with Phil and look forward to an opportunity to expand on this. I think the semantic web was the next biggest thing on there. And, you know, while I see the central nervous system as the Earth as a switch flip away from robot overlords, I see semantic web as maybe, you know, three switch flips away. Everything else on the list I put down in the noise at the bottom. Those two stand out.
Well, a couple of comments. First off, before we throw normal models of biomimicry away, you really got to read about the skink. Okay, you got to read about the sand skink and how it's using this electronic nanotechnology system in its body that we're imitating. I think one of the things that we didn't quite capture talking about biomimicry is that maybe we're only just now getting to a level of technological sophistication sufficient to enable us to really understand some of what nature is doing and to start to capitalize on that. So it's like, yeah, pointed stick was good, great in its day, but if we've got animals that are using some level of nanotechnology to make something super lubricated, super non-frictive, then that's actually pretty cool, and there's good stuff. I think my big concern about the semantic web is that I've been hearing about it for so long. And before it was the semantic web, it was the web. And before it was the web, it was hypertext. When I was working on my master's degree, that must have been 6 months ago or more. actually, a couple of decades ago, there was all this talk about hypertext, and you heard a lot of the same things about it that were then attributed to were going to happen with the web and are now attributed to will happen with the semantic web. And far be it for me to say that the big change isn't going to happen. Hopefully it will this time, but it starts to feel like fusion, which is always 30 years in the future, right? We're always 30 years away from fusion. Well, it seems like we're always just around the corner from this big meaning revolution in how information is linked to other information. But I would have to agree with you that if it kicks in, then it's going to be a very game-changing kind of technology. Great stuff. Well, thanks for that, Michael. And Stephen, what do we got going on music-wise this evening?
The band tonight that's going to play us out is the Zach Mack Band, and the song is Roll Me Over.
Roll Me Over by the Zach Mack Band. We'll look forward to listening to that. We'll be back again next week when we'll talk about our own take on breakthrough ideas. Until then, Stephen, thanks for your contributions this evening. Michael and everyone in the chat room and everyone listening live or recorded, thanks for being with us, and we look forward to being with you all on the next Fast Forward Radio. Until then, live to see it.